Hello and welcome to Palace Intrigue. I am your host, Mark Francis. The New York Times observed that it almost seemed like Elizabeth was in some ways the Queen of America. The Times wrote, "There she was at the NFL season opener, her smiling face ringing the Giants' circular screen just before the Buffalo Bills defeated the defending Super Bowl champions, the Los Angeles Rams. Brands, too, jumped in to offer condolences. Apple, for one, turned its homepage over to a black-and-white photo of the young monarch in a jeweled crown. Not even sites of the American Revolution were immune to royal mourning. Old North Church in Boston, where two lanterns were held high in 1775, as a signal from Paul Revere that the British were marching to Lexington and Concord, invited visitors to sign a condolence book for Queen Elizabeth II. Charles has inherited a crown. Some think it is cursed. The Mirror tells us the crown of the Queen Mother contains the Kohinoor diamond, which weighs more than 100 carats and carries with it a bloody history, not to mention rumored bad luck. The bedazzling headwear is one of many such objects owned by the monarchy as part of the crown jewels, including the imperial state crown that was placed on top of the Queen's coffin during her lying in state in Westminster Hall. However, the crown from 1937 is encrusted with the Kohinoor diamond, one of the largest cut precious stones in the world, and said to carry a deadly curse. According to ancient Hindu legend, men who wear it will own the world, but will also know all its misfortunes, reports the Daily Star. Rumors that the Kohinoor was cursed and full of misfortune for its owner began to spread, including its spirit being saturated by the bloodshed it was part of. Victoria wore it as a brooch before it found its way into the crown of Queen Alexandra in 1902 and then Queen Mary's in 1911, before its latest slot as part of the Queen Mother's coronation regalia. Until this year, the gem was last seen in public in 2002 when it was perched on top of the latter's coffin. Charles will not pay tax on his inheritance from the Queen. The Guardian reminds us he is exempt under the 1993 agreement, but Charles will pay income tax as his mother did. Under a clause agreed in 1993 by then Prime Minister John Major, any inheritance passed sovereign to sovereign avoids the 40% levy applied to assets valued at more than £325,000. The Crown Estate has an estimated $15.2 billion in assets, of which 25% of the profits are given to the royal family as the sovereign grant. The estate includes the Royal Archives and the Royal Collection of Paintings, which are held by the monarch in right of the crown. These assets cannot be sold by the king, and they are in effect surrendered to the government in return for a grant. The government's guidance concludes that it would therefore be inappropriate for inheritance tax to be paid in respect of such assets. Separately, Charles also inherits from the Queen the Duchy of Lancaster, a private estate that includes a portfolio of lands, properties, and assets held in trust for the sovereign. He is exempt from inheritance tax on these assets, among others, in order to preserve a degree of financial independence from the government of the day. The government guidance adds, "The monarchy as an institution needs sufficient private resources to enable it to continue to perform its traditional role in national life." Charles also inherits the Queen's swans, assuming they were ever really hers. The Guardian reminds us that the swans are known as the Queen's birds, and most people think Her Majesty owned all of the long-necked feathered creatures in the country, but it turns out that wasn't strictly true. Due to a medieval tradition, the late monarch had the title Seigneur of the Swans, and with it came the right to claim ownership of the birds if she wanted to. Furthermore, the long-standing rule only applied to one type of swan, the mute swan, and only in open waters. As the seigneur of the swans, the queen exercised only part of her right on an 80-mile stretch of the River Thames from Sunbury-on-Thames, Surrey, to Abingdon, Oxon. So while Her Majesty did indeed own a small portion of the swans in the country, she didn't own half as many as people thought or as many as she could have. The Queen considered the swans on the 5-mile stretch, which meanders down from Boveney Lock on the outskirts of Windsor, around the Crown Estate land and the castle to Old Windsor, as her flock. She began the tradition known as the swan upping, where birds were rounded up, tagged, and then released back into the wild, a process that was watched over by her swan marker, David Barber. David worked with the Royal Swans for 30 years and said he believed King Charles III would continue the tradition. He said, "The king has the right to claim any swan swimming in open waters, unmarked if he so wishes." Not all the swans belong to the king, but if he wishes to claim them, he can by the royal prerogative. The ownership of the swans dates back to medieval times, as the birds were considered a delicacy and had to be protected. David continued, swans then were an extremely important food source and served up at banquets and feasts, really for the wealthy. As time went on, different people owned swans. The crown gave them the right to own them, and they had the young cygnets and they would fatten them up for Christmas feasts. Of course, today swans are no longer eaten, and it's all a conservation and education exercise. During his 30 years working as the Queen's swan marker, David met the Queen several times and they spoke often about the birds. He added, she was a very, very lovely person. You could get on with her very well, and she took a grand interest in all wildlife, but swans as well. Palace Intrigue will be right back. People wondered what kind of king Charles will be. Most of the issues that matter to him, climate change, employment, prospects for young people, interfaith relations, are also relevant right across the Commonwealth, notes a source close to the new king. Still, as the longest-serving heir apparent, Charles was familiar to Britons, many of whom regard him as a fussy intellectual, more head than heart. His mother, by contrast, was widely beloved. Aware since childhood that he would someday be king, Charles has lived his life knowing that his accession could come at any moment. In reality, long decades passed. That time allowed him to evolve past his tabloid image as an adulterer with a predilection for naughty phone calls to one of a grandfather of five settled into a stable second marriage. Friends cheer his sense of social responsibility. Critics deride him as a meddler. He has long been scathing of modern steel and glass architecture. In 1984, he loudly opposed early plans for an addition to London's National Gallery that he likened to a carbuncle on the face of a much-loved friend. The scheme was scrapped in one of his notable victories. Will Charles be able to suppress or at least tone down a lifetime of vocal advocacy? Those who know him say that Charles did down his advocacy as the throne neared. He is operating with more caution, says Mayer. As king, he will enjoy weekly meetings with whomever is the Prime Minister of the day, and he will exercise in those meetings his right as sovereign to be consulted, to encourage and to warn, the last of these especially vigorously. And there you have it. If you'd like to email us, our address is thepalaceintrigue@gmail.com. Please follow us on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, wherever you get your favorite shows. I'm Mark Francis. My thanks to John McDermott. Palace Intrigue and good times.